the impression that Lycos leadership would think any increase in illicit use would not be a bug, but a feature. Again, I am a former psychonaut, and I do fully support people who got healing in this trial or elsewhere from psychedelics. And I support continuing research into MDMA therapy. But while Lycos leadership may envision a spiritualized humanity, in this very study, Lycos treated the people who were harmed under their care with a falsely spiritual inhumanity. Regardless of the decision made today and in August, the public deserves to know that. Thank you.
That was the Reverend Joe Welker, pastor at the East Craftsbury Presbyterian Church in Craftsbury, Vermont, providing public comment at a June 4th meeting of the FDA's Psychopharmacologic Drugs Advisory Committee, at which the committee was considering an application for approval of MDMA-assisted therapy, which was submitted by Lycos Therapeutics. The committee voted against the application, recommending that FDA reject it. A final decision by the agency is expected by August 11th. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hi, this is Melissa Lesniak, the creator and host of That Vegan Show. On That Vegan Show, you will hear in-depth guest interviews on vegan-related topics, such as companion animals, environmentalism, social issues, and food and nutrition. We also learn about specific animals, such as possums and rabbits, including their needs and ways to help them. Be sure to tune in to That Vegan Show on the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m., right here on KBOO Portland.
Hello, my name is TK Kapurai and I'm an immigrant from Zimbabwe. I'm the host of The Global Cell, which airs live in the Air Room the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. I host immigrants and refugees from various global spots. I like to bring out their lived experiences so the world can know something about them. I like to bring a lot through my guests so we may have diverse experiences, cultures, foods, music, interests, and anything on the platform. We can share and learn a lot through their live instructions. Let's do this together, not only for a better platform for our community, but a better community for our platform. Again, tune in for my show, The Global Cell, live in the Air Room, the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and also available on the web at kboo.fm.
B.B. King, you know the guy that plays that guitar called Lucille, and when I'm in Portland, I get my blues from KBOO. That's 90.7 FM on your radio. Please stay tuned. They might play one of my records.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Welcome to a special Juneteenth edition of Grassroot News. Just what is Juneteenth?
Juneteenth means to me progression, transition.
Juneteenth, a cross between June and 19, commemorates the official end of slavery in Texas on June 19, 1865. That's over 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed into law by President Lincoln. News of their new freedoms was slow to reach some slaves throughout the country, and historians theorize that Texan slave owners suppressed the information in order to get one final cotton harvest from the slaves. On June 19, 1865, Major General Gordon Granger and Union troops arrived in Galveston to announce the war had ended and deliver General Order No. 3, which proclaimed that all slaves were free. The first official Juneteenth celebration took place in Texas a year later and became a state holiday in 1980. Juneteenth is celebrated in many ways, ranging from parades to cookouts and other activities. But Juneteenth isn't just about celebrations. It also serves as a time to further the conversation on the legacy left by slavery in the United States, and as a means of discussing ways to address it, like the hotly contested topic of reparations.
We recognize our lineage as a generational trust, as inheritance. And the real dilemma posed by reparations is just that, a dilemma of inheritance. It is impossible to imagine America without the inheritance of slavery.
First sponsored by John Conyers in 1989 and reintroduced every session until his retirement in 2017, the Commission to Study and Develop Reparation Proposals for African Americans Act tries to tackle the subject. The bill is now sponsored by Texas Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee in the House and Senator Cory Booker in the Senate.
Though I am gratified that we are having this hearing on Juneteenth, for those of us who understand Juneteenth, 2 years after the proclamation, Emancipation Proclamation, there were those Africans who did not have freedom until 1865. H.R. 40 is in fact the response of the United States of America long overdue. Slavery is the original sin. Slavery has never received an apology.
So enslavement built America, and the American Civil War was fought to keep slavery. This all started in 1619. History professor George Trent Vinson breaks it all down.
By 1619, 500,000 enslaved Africans had already made their way across the Atlantic, primarily to Brazil and Spanish colonies in South America and the Caribbean. So with that context, we see that slavery is not new, and we see that transatlantic slave trading is not new. That began in 1502. What is new about the 1619 Africans is that this is the beginning of a particular racialized slavery in what becomes English North America. For the 1619 Africans, what happens here is I think there's a realization that, oh, here we have a permanent labor force at our disposal. We don't have to release them after 4 to 7 years like they did the indentured servants. And in a labor-starved colony like Jamestown, I think people like Yardley and Piercy and other landholders see this as an opportunity. They don't necessarily speak the same language. The Africans are not, they don't share the similar cultural context. They have no home country of England to appeal to for rights to make claims of citizenship. And phenotypically, they look differently. They're easily marked out as a distinct labor class. And we see this in the labor categories of the early colony, where they're described as Negroes or servants not Christians, which was another way to describe them, to differentiate them in the records. So we have this combination of class and race coming together to create caste, a dynamic that presumes a permanent inferior group of people. And this is where we get the development of racial slavery. This is why Jamestown is so important for North American history. It's not that slavery was new, right? But it's this particular form of racial slavery that develops in what becomes America that creates that racial caste system and ideas, ideologies of white supremacy and black inferiority that continued over these 246 years of slavery and beyond. So the interesting dynamic of all of this, the result of all of this, is that by 1860, on the eve of the Civil War, America has 4 million enslaved people, which makes it the largest slave society in world history. And that began at Jamestown.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis made the decision to dilute American history by placing conservatives in positions of educational decision-making and challenging any information that promotes intersectionality. That's the bridge where all ages and nationalities can see we can build towards a common purpose while addressing historical wrongs. Reverend Cecil?
Well, I think the power structure in America recognized that if people and communities recognized the way in which they are all oppressed by the power structure, and if we were able to hear one another's stories, recognize our common struggles, and find ways in which we can work together, that power structure, that thing which has enabled this machine to continue for all these many centuries, will begin to collapse. So this insistence to not allow communities to recognize their commonalities, to be able to work together, to recognize that they are all interconnected, that we are all interconnected, that, as others have said, that when one community is oppressed, we all are oppressed, and to recognize that our enemies are not those who are struggling with us for the pieces of crumbs, but recognize that there is a power structure which deny all of us the ability to live into our full humanity. When we have the ability to recognize our commonality, those in power, the power structure itself, is threatened and will continue to do everything it can do and has done. If we just take a casual look of American history and the way in which the power structure has encouraged the division of people who have been oppressed from working together. So throughout the history, poor people, people who are outside the power system, have often been pitted against one another rather than being able to recognize their commonality. And the amazing thing for me is to recognize that in spite of all that effort to separate peoples and communities, that many times people resist that argument and see that we are connected with one another and find ways to work together. So I think when there is that continued oppression and work to divide communities, that we must continue to work as hard to find ways in which people can hear one another's and find ways to work together.
DeSantis's crusade on diversity and race comes in a state colonized by the Spanish, where there's intersections of Black, Latino, and Indigenous culture and history. But DeSantis claims African-American AP history is indoctrination. This claim is a part of the big backlash against racial understanding.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
At the edge of Central Park in Manhattan, there's a bronze statue of a doctor named James Marion Sims, whose brilliant achievement carried the fame of American surgery throughout the entire world. He's the guy who created the vaginal speculum, an instrument gynecologists use for examination. He pioneered the surgical repair for fistula, a complication from childbirth, and became known as the father of modern gynecology. But that brilliant achievement was the result of a series of excruciating experimental surgeries that he conducted on enslaved women. In a lot of ways, Sims epitomizes the story of American medicine for Black women. It's a system that's failing them to this day. From infant mortality to life expectancy, the racial disparities in healthcare are staggering. The gulf between Black and white might be widest when we look at maternal mortality, with Black women 3 to 4 times more likely to die in connection with pregnancy or birth than white women. And that divide can be traced back to doctors like Sims, who contributed to a long, largely overlooked history of institutional racism in medicine.
Trying to understand a historical problem without knowing its history is like trying to treat a patient without eliciting a thorough medical history. You're doomed to failure.
That's Harriet Washington, a medical ethicist and author who chronicled the intersection of race and medicine in her book, Medical Apartheid. While many of the stark racial disparities in healthcare can be attributed to environmental and economic factors like access to good healthcare, studies show that minority patients tend to receive a lower quality of care than non-minorities, even when they have the same types of health insurance or the same ability to pay for care.
As African Americans, we've been abused for so long, consistently by the system. Why should we trust it? Why should we go to it when ill? And that's iatrophobia. That's a fear of the healer, you know, inculcated by the behavior of those healers, unfortunately.
It starts with slavery. Doctors relied on slave owners for financial stability. They accompanied plantation masters to auctions to verify the fitness of slaves and were called in to treat sick slaves to protect their owners' investments. In 1807, Congress abolished the importation of slaves and in turn pushed Black women to have more children, to essentially breed slaves. Founding Father Thomas Jefferson later wrote, "I consider a woman who brings a child every 2 years as more profitable than the best man on the farm." Around the 1830s, the abolitionist movement led to the rise of what was called Negro medicine, or efforts to identify Black inferiority to justify slavery. And there were polygenists who tried to use both science and the Bible to find proof that races evolved from different origins. The 1830s also marked the beginning of recorded experimentation on Black women's bodies. One doctor performed experimental C-sections on slaves. Another one perfected the dangerous ovariotomy, or removal of an ovary, by testing the procedure on slave women. In fact, half the original articles in the 1836 Southern Medical and Surgical Journal dealt with experiments on Black people. And then, of course, there was James Marion Sims, whose reputation is etched in history and on that statue in Central Park. Between 1845 and 1849, Sims began performing experimental surgeries on a 17-year-old slave named Anarka. He eventually performed 30 operations on Anarka and more surgeries on about 11 other female slaves. When his male colleagues could no longer bear to assist him in inflicting pain on the women, the slaves took turns restraining one another. Yet paintings depicting Sims, Anarka, and other slave women presented a subdued version of his experiments. Even though anesthesia was introduced in 1846, Sims chose not to use it for his experimentation with slaves. His practices echoed one of the most prevalent and dangerous beliefs in medicine at the time, that Black people did not feel pain or anxiety. This book from 1851, titled The Natural History of Human Species, claimed the American dark races bear with indifference tortures insupportable to a white man. Studies released as recently as last year demonstrate that Black people are less likely to be treated for pain, particularly in the ER. There's even one from a children's hospital that found the same to be true for kids. And just this year, Pearson Education, a leading educational publisher, issued an apology and recalled nursing textbooks that included racist stereotypes, like this section that said Black people often report higher pain intensity than other cultures.
Well, what does it mean when you say that someone doesn't feel pain? Among other things, you're speaking about their humanity. These are all part of that suite of beliefs emanating from the 19th century that we still have not shaken off. Despite all our knowledge and sophistication, they're deeply ingrained.
Doctors like Sims might fit the Dr. Frankenstein stereotype, but they weren't outliers. Historically, Southern doctors who used Black bodies for troubling experiments were the norm.
It's a very common question. How can we judge our forebears? You know, those guys in the 18th century who practiced medicine in a way that appalls us today. You know, we think, How could you do that? I did not judge the practitioners based on our own ethics. I judged them based on the ethics of their time. It was not acceptable back then. We just did not hear from the people who protested against it.
After the Civil War ended, the 1900s brought a wave of immigrants to the U.S. It sparked a race panic and coincided with the birth of the American eugenics movement. One of the movement's key objectives was to reduce the childbearing potential of the poor and disabled. Leaders included birth control pioneer and Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger, who eventually devised the controversial Negro Project, or family planning centers that pushed birth control in the Black South. It was a project that even garnered support from W.E.B. Du Bois, a founder of the NAACP, who wrote that Black people bred carelessly and disastrously. By the mid-1930s, more than half the states passed pro-sterilization laws, and often sterilization was forced. In 1961, future civil rights leader Fannie Lou Hamer went to the hospital to have a tumor removed, but was subjected to a hysterectomy without consent. The procedure, which rendered women infertile without their knowledge, was so common in the South that Hamer is said to have dubbed it the Mississippi appendectomy.
African-American babies were no longer economically valuable. And African-Americans themselves had gone from being a resource to a nuisance.
In June of 1973, the SPLC uncovered 100 to 150,000 cases of women who had been sterilized with federal funds in Alabama. Half the women were Black. In recent decades, women of color continue to be exposed to dubious reproductive health programs. In December 1990, the FDA approved a contraceptive called Norplant, and it was selectively marketed to Black teenagers in Baltimore schools.
You know, one of the current birth control methods now in the United States is Norplant.
Norplant fans like David Duke, the former KKK Grand Wizard, even introduced legislation to give women on welfare an annual reward of $100 if they agreed to get Norplant.
And it's time we start to encourage welfare mothers to be responsible.
That bill never passed, but the implant ignited a debate on whether long-term contraception, like Norplant that lasted 5 years, could be used as a form of social engineering when pushed to specific communities. Today, as we continue to lose Black mothers at alarming rates, a deeper look at the past may be a good step towards creating a more equitable healthcare system.
If you're just joining us, this is a grassroots news special on the holiday, Juneteenth. Now, you just heard Fox News piece on how the bodies of enslaved Black women advance medicine. Now, the labors of enslaved men and women also advance early capitalism in America.
The New York Times 1619 Project, which is spotlighting parts of history that are less well known. We are going to focus on some of the economic legacies, including the larger connections with modern capitalism. Specifically, we're going to look at how the production of American sugar, known as white gold, helped to fuel slavery and became ingrained in our society. Historian Khalil Gibran Muhammad of Harvard's Kennedy School wrote about that for the New York Times. Louisiana, he wrote, led the nation in destroying the lives of Black people in the name of economic efficiency. And he joins me now. Professor Muhammad, thank you very much for being here. Help us understand how sugar is connected to the origins of American slavery.
Sugar was the most dominant economic incentive for European colonization of the Americas. No other crop was as abundant or successful in drawing Europeans to these shores, and I mean by that North America and South America, for the purpose of cultivating sugar for a worldwide market, and particularly for Europe, that had already established a taste for sugar, but would grow exponentially in terms of demand over time. There's no way to really understand the significance of the colonization of the Americas without understanding the role of sugar in it.
And how, and explain how slavery played such an important role from the very beginning.
Sure. So the origin story, of course, is that Christopher Columbus brings some cane stalks with him by way of the Spanish Canary Islands in 1493. So sugar is already part of the globe, but it has not become the commodity in bulk form that it will become once Christopher Columbus brings it to the New World. As such, sugar was always an incredibly difficult product to produce. First, the cane itself is heavy and unwieldy.
Right.
And secondly, to take the plant and turn it into sugar required incredible labor and often dangerous and difficult labor.
And you write about how, of course, that began in the 1600s, but then it went on literally for hundreds of years. It changed shape. You get closer to the Civil War, and the shape of the sugar industry has changed, but still slaves are an essential piece of it.
Absolutely. So Louisiana doesn't get into the business of sugarcane cultivation until the end of the 18th century. As a result of the attempt to cultivate sugar, it blossomed and bloomed. And by the top of the 19th century, Louisiana was producing about a quarter of the world's cane sugar supply. It was a pretty miraculous turnaround. But all of that was made possible by the enslavement of people of African descent.
And I know I'm asking you to skip over a lot of history here, but you move forward to today, to the 20th and even into the 21st century, and you write about how the legacy of what happened in Louisiana and other places still plays a role in the economy. A vital role in the economy of this country.
Well, if we go from sugar to cotton, we basically explain two crops that in their totality explain much of the infrastructure of our capitalist economy to this day. We can explain everything from the abundance of land that was originally held by the indigenous and the labor of enslaved people as America's competitive advantage. By the 19th century, cotton, for example, was essentially the major export of the United States. And that cotton export helped make possible the wealth not only in enslaved people, but also the wealth of banks in the North that were responsible for financing investments in this country that were often mortgaged on the basis of enslaved people. There's no way to really understand the economic might of America by the 19th century without understanding the role of cotton slavery and earlier sugar slavery in it.
They're one of the other writers for these series of articles in the Sunday New York Times. Matthew Desmond, he's a professor at Princeton, writes about how not only that today's economy has its roots in slavery, but that modern American capitalism is as severe as it is in its treatment of people, and that too has its roots in slavery. Some people are going to look at that and say, is that a leap too far? How do you answer that?
Well, it's a good question, and I can see why people would give pause. But if we take a step back and we really ask a fair question, we could ask ourselves, has our economy been built on the notion of personhood or profit? And in that sense, from slavery to the late 19th century of immigration of Europeans from around the world to the 20th century today, people have been ground up in our economy for the purpose of money making. How else would you explain the great labor unrest of the late 19th and early 20th century that brought us essentially our modern social welfare system, eventually in the New Deal, but for the fact that capitalism created misery for people at the lowest end of the economic totem pole? That's our history, whether we like it or not. Some people prospered in that system, but it was a system that was often quite brutal to workers who were responsible for doing the heavy lifting of our economy.
Finally, why is it important, Professor Muhammad, that Americans understand what you've written about?
Well, it's important because we don't treat our past with the same commitment to truth and honesty and accuracy as we do, say, science and technology. If there's a concern in this day and age about the questioning global warming or climate change, if scientists are under attack for making things up, that's a new phenomenon, a product of our late 20th century. But we've been having culture wars about how to interpret the American past from the very beginning. And the consequences of that are what drove the editors of the 1619 Project to look closely at the work of academic historians, just like many people look at the work of scientists and say, what do academic historians tell us about the past that we have not been teaching and we've not learned as well as we should?
Khalil Gibran Muhammad. He's a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School, one of the writers for this New York Times series, The 1619 Project, looking at the 400th anniversary of the beginning of slavery.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
Mary Lee?
I'm going to say some words. The edits of what got taken out of those AP courses are not accidental. They are part of this ongoing onslaught against anything that might disagree with a white supremacy culture understanding of who they are and what their entitlement is for how they are treated in our society. And by the way, how we continue to treat African-American, women, queer, anyone else who's not white and male, or white adjacent white women, right? White male adjacent white women. I also want to say, while deeply, deeply disappointing and enraging, I think we can't think about this in an exceptionalism way. We have to understand that here in Portland, Oregon, we had a series of very deeply researched and long time work called the Baseline Essays that were meant to provide guidance to educators in Portland Public Schools related to the teaching of African American, Asian American, Latine, and Native American history, both in nationally and in the local area. And those baseline essays were also very challenged. They're not actually really implemented in the ways in which the community had hoped to implement them. So I want to contextualize this with, it's too easy to think about Mr. DeSantis as, you know, some kind of an exceptionally bad person doing exceptionally bad things. He is a bad person doing bad things. And we are also here locally part and parcel of that that movement. And that understanding that somehow to our rhetoric to the contrary, we don't actually care that much about children. We don't care about educating them to be citizens of the world. We don't care about equipping them with the skill sets that will help them succeed in a changing world, in a diverse world, in a world where people of color are the majority. And we're doing that at our danger. A danger to ourselves, a danger to democracy, and a danger to our very ability to live and work and play and be with each other. So, yeah, despicable. The AP folks who cowed to this, cowardly, cowardly, cowardly. And we got to understand that we all are a part of it too.
Welcome back to our special on Juneteenth. My name's Lenita Duke from Grassroots News. This is sort of a journalistic roundtable, sort of explaining what Juneteenth is, the antecedent for Juneteenth, and where we stand as a nation, as the enslaved people of America stand up.
This is Nia Gray with a special faith report to commemorate Juneteenth. Juneteenth is a 155-year-old holiday celebrating the emancipation of African Americans from slavery in the United States. It would be remiss not to discuss the relationship between white Christianity and slavery. Racism began with slavery. For hundreds of years, so-called Christian white Southern slave owners used the Bible to legitimize and justify slavery. Even an article in the Charleston Mercury in the 1800s claimed that Jesus supported slavery. There were many common arguments made by Christians at this time. One is the fake teaching that Ham, the son of Noah, had black skin because he was cursed by Noah into servitude for his brothers, i.e., being a slave. This teaching was used to justify racism and slavery of people with dark skin across the world. It has been used throughout history in Nazi Germany and apartheid South Africa. This is false doctrine. Noah cursed Canaan, not Ham. These slave masters used charitable and evangelical reasons like slavery brings heathens to a Christian land where they can hear the gospel. Christian masters provided religious instruction for their slaves. They taught the Bible to encourage slaves to be good slaves. However, black and white Christian abolitionists who were biblically literate, like Frederick Douglass and the English Baptist pastor Charles Spurgeon, spoke out against slavery. In fact, Spurgeon said, "I do from my inmost soul detest slavery. And although I commune at the Lord's table with men of all creeds, yet with a slaveholder I have no fellowship of any sort or kind. I would soon think of receiving a murderer into my church as a man-stealer." This made Spurgeon public enemy number one throughout the southern states. Anti-Spurgeon bonfires burned his anti-slavery writings. Anyone who sold Spurgeon's sermons in North Carolina faced imprisonment for circulating incendiary publications. Can you imagine a white evangelical pastor today standing up with Black Lives Matter with anti-racist sermons and having Trump and white nationalist evangelical people issuing death threats to him? I encourage all people of faith to use this example. Don't let false doctrine poison your mind. And our faith supports social justice in every form. Happy Juneteenth. You've been listening to the Grassroots News Special on the Juneteenth holiday.
Professor Johnson?
This is just astonishing to me. I don't know when Governor DeSantis became an expert on education, but somehow it happened recently. And it's the hypocrisy of it is, I think, my first reaction, because he's talking about wokeness and cancel culture. To me, this is cancel culture when you are denying people the choice to take AP classes and to take AP classes on these subjects that are important contemporary subjects, which we've made a lot of progress on. And this just seems like he's turned the car around and wants us to go backwards. I'm pretty appalled. I'm appalled that this was even considered and that this change was made. And I really would like to see politics stay out of education and that we focus more on what kind of citizens do we want to produce. Do we want them to be culturally aware? Do we want them to have some kind of understanding? And this is just the opposite of, to me, creating an informed citizen, which I think should be part of the goal of education.
My thoughts on the matter, the first thing when I think of AP, I took AP classes in high school. I went to public high school in a very, very liberal area. And AP US History was the first time that I started to get a taste of actual American history. Of course, it had been taught in one way or another in my schooling up until that point, but that was when I first started to be able to understand the actually complicated and complex history of the United States that informs literally everything that is going on. And one, not everybody gets that opportunity, but for me, AP, the College Board, had a decent reputation in that regard. And even in the draft that was released, I believe NBC News published their initial draft, that it seemed to fulfill on a lot of these things of what would a advanced placement African American studies class really look like? What would we really want people to understand and know? And my hypothesis is that this this revision, this cowing to conservatives, will still be dismissed out of hand as critical race theory. I believe that that will be the case. I believe that nothing will be accomplished by censoring in this way, because I don't, obviously, I mean, critical race theory, whatever they're saying that is, that's not what it is. We can't chase ourselves in circles about it anymore. I don't believe that this will actually result in Florida high schoolers being able to learn what's left of this curriculum. I don't think that these changes will have made a difference. I think that it's important to point out that the College Board produces AP curriculum on French language and culture, German language and culture, Japanese language and culture. And these are, we're talking about cultures that are not native to the United States. And so that this is so controversial, I think it's important to notice that. And also that the College Board and AP classes represent an opportunity to obtain college credit as a high schooler. And that by that AP classes are desirable for students because of that reason. And so to have the opportunity to get a credit in a African American studies class in high school, that also has economic implications in terms of how quickly can you complete high school or how quickly can you complete college. I think that all of those things kind of overlap. I think that what's the point in censoring the truth? The truth is still going to be out there. People are still going to be curious and interested in it. And I think that this watered down version is, it's bad for academic integrity. I can't quite conjure the good words that Mary had there, but it is despicable. It's not right. And I mean that their original draft was published, I think makes that all the more stark, that this wasn't their initial plan. Their initial plan wasn't to include or disinclude all of these things. And one of the, I think, the most powerful things taking a history class, especially as a high schooler, is like, why do we stop in the 50s? Why do I not get to know what Ronald Reagan did? Maybe we'll talk about, hey, 9/11, that was bad. You guys were alive for that. Wasn't that, you don't remember it, but you were alive. History is happening now. It's happening all around us. And kids today have seen that more than anybody. The pandemic, this incoming recession, the Black Lives Matter movement, those are major moments in history. And so to deny that any of that is happening and to water it down is awful.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things. Talk about things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
You know, the impact of slavery is with us in America, in our institutions, in the school, in the way the police department runs, in the way people of color, particularly African Americans, are hired in this country or not hired. These same companies that are promoting Juneteenth are the same companies and cities and counties who discriminate against Black people in the way they are hired, if they are hired at all. And once hired, how often are they promoted? Slavery is in our DNA, not only in our institutions, but within us personally in our DNA. I wrote a satire years ago, and I called it Jeff Sessions' DNA Bleaching Kit.
Have you taken a DNA test from a direct-to-consumer ancestry testing site such as 23andMe, Ancestry.com, FamilyTree DNA, or GED Match? Did the results conflict with your family history by saying you had African, South American, or Asian blood? Did the results contradict with what you look like in the mirror or your family history? Well, don't let those DNA results stop you from loving Trump, Robert E. Lee, Fox News, or the Confederate flag. Purchase a Jeff Sessions DNA Bleaching Kit. At Jeff Sessions DNA Bleaching Kit, we will remove all unwanted lineages from your DNA. We will pop out all those chocolate chips in your cookie mix or your DNA. Just reject the validity of those genetic tests and those unwanted DNA markers. To hell with the science and to hell with the algorithms. Forget history. Studies have shown that European Americans also have non-European ancestry. Now, this includes African, Native American, and Asian. The frequency of European Americans who carry African ancestry varies strongly by state. Now, European Americans with African ancestry are found at a much higher rate in the South than in any other parts of the United States. States with the most racial tensions are also the ones where the whitest people have black ancestors. The findings published in the American Journal of Human Genetics found that whites in the South were far more likely to have black ancestors than any other part of the country. Therefore, it does not matter if your great-great-great uncle raped a slave or that your DNA matches looks like an NBA basketball team. At Jeff Sessions DNA Bleaching Kit, the facts do not matter. It's what you feel. And what you see is who you are.
Welcome back to our final chapter as we celebrate and try to understand the holiday, Juneteenth. I'm your moderator, Lenita Duke from Grassroots News.
Mary Lee, what are your thoughts on that?
I have to say, I'm not sure that it's prioritizing the feelings of white children, because I don't think that any human being starts out as a child and understands oppression and white supremacy. I think those things are taught. I think this is actually about the adults feeling uncomfortable and the white adults prioritizing their own feelings over clearly what are the reality that their children are experiencing in these classrooms, which are becoming more and more brown. It's, again, part of this strategic approach that I think we must spend a lot of our time and effort understanding. If the right can continue to create confusion and leverage our own discomfort on the progressive side of things for taking space for who we are, we've talked about this before, to be a bold and unapologetic about what we stand for, the use of these terms. Nia, you were just talking about how all of these terms, critical race theory, woke, political correctness, have been taken and turned against and used as a weapon against the progressive movement. And there is something about, you know, continuing to grasp the dying shreds of their white supremacy will not be pulled out of their cold, you know, dead grasp that flavors all of this conversation and all of this strategy. And I'll tell you what is so insidious about this for me is it's parading children who I would posit in our culture, we talk a lot about protecting and uplifting, and we do very little of it as in reality. But we're parading them out as the, you know, the poor lambs that must be protected. And what instead we are doing is we are teaching hate. We are teaching hate to white children, and we are teaching them to understand their entitlement within a white supremacist society. And worst of all, we are teaching our own children to at least question themselves, be divorced from their history, from their legacy, from their truth that would help them stand against the onslaught of the white supremacy culture. And at the worst, we are making them hate themselves. Because when they are given these lessons, when they are kept from information, when they are told lies that are based in white supremacy, we hear it. They hear it. It goes right into their heads and hearts. And I think there is the basis of some of the conversation we've had about at what point does the progressive community or the left start to question ourselves about our lack of ability to be legitimate and to see ourselves as legitimate and to heal from all of that internalized oppression, to build a new perspective and a new way forward. And as long as this kind of behavior continues, our children are being indoctrinated just as their children are being indoctrinated. And we will not see the changed world that we're interested in. So I think it's less about the children, even though we're all about the children in this society. We like to talk about the children, the poor children, and it's about the adults. It's always about the adults.
Cecil, same question to you. What are your thoughts?
I appreciate what Mary had to say about it's all about the adults. First of all, we all recognize that parenting, raising children is a challenging, difficult job. All of us know what it is like to try to create an environment for our children where they are safe, where they are able to meet the challenges they face, and we all want to protect our children. But we also need to recognize that oftentimes we do not have the knowledge or the skills or even the desire to address some things that children may want answers for. And it has been our own experience, and I believe our children's experience, that the teacher is often the one you may go to that you trust. And we should continue to support our teachers. And this is a whole, I don't want to go off and talking about how we fail to pay our teachers or support them enough. But the fact is that teachers are the adults that children trust and depend on. And that when we seek to limit the ability of teachers to talk about things we don't want to talk about, we don't want to talk to our children about sex. We don't want to talk to our children about race. We don't want to talk to our children about how people continue to mistreat and destroy our environment. And I think that we need to continue to find ways in which we allow our teachers to do what they are trained to do, to listen, to care for, and to guide our students.
We have a parent in Nia, so I'd like to hear, Nia, what your thoughts are.
Well, so much about what I remember learning about Black history and what it means to be a Black woman happened at home. I actually don't remember any significant, it's Black History Month, maybe there was some Black History Minutes, but everything I learned at home or through community leaders. And that's how it's always going to be, that there's only so much that they can do at school or learn at school. I think what happens is as a parent, you teach your child in whether it's love or hate, acceptance, really where it's demonstrated is at school. I think by the time they get to school, maybe it was Mary Lee that said that they've already been sort of wired and groomed to feel a certain way about racism and people that are different from them. And Ava, who's my daughter, who's 9, in the 4th grade, I believe it was like in the 2nd grade, maybe around elections, where my daughter hears me participating and having conversations about Black Lives Matter, about LGBTQ, trans rights and things like that. And so she's in a rural community because her grandparents are Caucasian, and she's in this rural area with chalk drawing rainbow flags and writing Black Lives Matter all over her grandparents' driveway because that's what we teach in our house. But then she went to school and she said, well, one of her friends has a giant Donald Trump, and she goes to mostly Caucasian suburban school, has a big Donald Trump flag in their front yard and is in the classroom telling her that Donald Trump is going to save America. You know, even at Ava's age, these children are having these conversations, but, you know, it's what they learn at home that sort of comes out at school and stains or paints the way that the children, you know, deal with each other as friends and classmates. I wanted to bring up sort of another issue with what we're talking about and the bigger picture beyond teaching accurate American and world history. What's interesting is all of this is under the guise of individual liberty. One other thing Ava brought home to me that a young man, instead of saying, yes, this is good, no, this is bad, he just said, and I'm guessing he heard it from his dad or his mom, that he's about individual liberty. Under the guise of this individual liberty, you can limit discussions about race and discrimination. And that's actually the name of some of the bills in Florida, the Individual Liberty Bill. In addition to that, under that umbrella, you can also see their anti-masking and anti-woke sort of propaganda all under the umbrella of this individual liberty.
It's the United States' 12th federal holiday, a day to mark the end of slavery, Juneteenth.
Great nations don't ignore their most painful moments. They don't ignore those moments in the past. They embrace them. We come to terms with the mistakes we made. And in remembering those moments, we begin to heal and grow stronger.
June 19, 1865 was the day the last enslaved African Americans in Galveston, Texas, learned that slavery had been abolished 2.5 years earlier.
For more than 2 years, they were intentionally kept from their freedom. For more than 2 years. And then on that summer day, 156 years ago, the enslaved people of Texas learned the news. They learned that they were free.
Juneteenth has long been commemorated by Black Americans in particular, but the date has taken on renewed resonance in recent years as Americans confront the country's living legacy of racism. Activists say making it a national holiday is symbolically important, but it's just one step on the path to racial justice.
So I enjoy hearing stories I've never heard of about unsung African-American men and women. And I was unfamiliar with the relationship of Nelson Rockefeller and Martin Luther King. I watched an interview with Clarence B. Jones on MSNBC last weekend and was just tickled by this story that when Martin Luther King and hundreds of children were arrested after the Children's March in Birmingham, civil rights organizers wanted to, you know, raise some cash to make bail. And a lot of people were really upset that these children had to even spend 1 minute in jail. So apparently Harry Belafonte and Clarence B. Jones got a call from the Rockefellers that said they would help, and they had $100,000. That Jones actually signed a promissory note inside a big bank vault, which I can't even imagine what that must have been like, pretty intimidating after hours in a Chase bank. And he personally signed a promissory note in exchange for $100,000 in cash. And what was interesting is he called out that this type of promissory note, he was financially on the line. And the type was, when the creditor says, I want my money now, you better pay it in person. So the story is that the children were bailed out, and then Jones received a receipt from the Rockefellers that said paid in full. So just a reminder that hope can come from unlikely allies.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroots News Northwest.
have some gravy in your ear. This is Wavy Gravy, Temple of Accumulated Error and Voice of Woodstock, telling you you are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. The 90s are the 60s, standing on your...